Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Teleforum Conference Call. This afternoon's topic is a Teleforum on the myths and facts regarding the EPA's Benefit Cost Analysis and Science Transparency Rules. My name is Michael Wallman, and I'm the Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have with us our moderator, Darren Bast, who is a Senior Research Fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Darren will be introducing our panel today. After our panel has their opening remarks, we will then move to an audience Q&A. Thank you all for sharing with us today. And Darren, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Micah. And I want to thank all of you for calling in to today's Teleforum. So over the last month, the EPA has finalized two important regulations that are designed in large part to promote transparency. The first rule that was finalized in early December is entitled Increasing Consistency in Considering Benefits and Costs in the Clean Air Act Rulemaking Process. Now, as the title suggests, the rule focuses on addressing benefit cost analysis by the agency in the context of the Clean Air Act. The second rule is entitled Strengthening Transparency in Pivotal Science Underlying Significant Regulatory Actions and Influential Scientific Information. This rule is intended to help the public and outside experts properly evaluate the science used in the EPA's regulatory decision-making, as well as when the agency disseminates influential scientific information. The goal of improving transparency is far from controversial and has long garnered bipartisan support. For example, President Barack Obama stated in a 2009 memorandum about scientific integrity across the government, quote, "The public must be able to trust science and scientific process informing public policy decisions," end quote. The EPA, through its science transparency rule, is trying to create this trust. Despite the modest and common sense goals of these rules, there has been opposition to them. Recent media reports about the final rules have provided misleading information, and that's me being charitable. So what do these rules really do? Why are they important? And what are the myths and what are the facts? Today, we're going to discuss these issues and more. Here's the format for the program. We'll hear from our experts, who I'll introduce in a second. We'll have a brief discussion among the three of us, and then we'll have plenty of time for your questions. And we're very fortunate today to have two leading experts. You can see their full bios on the Federalist Society website. Rachel Jones is our first speaker, and she'll discuss the benefit-cost rule. Rachel is Vice President of Energy and Resources Policy at the National Association of Manufacturers. Before joining the National Association of Manufacturers, Rachel was the Environment and Energy Counsel for the U.S. House of Representatives Committee on Science, Space, and Technology. Clint Woods will speak second and will discuss the Science Transparency Rule. He is the Policy Fellow for Regulations at Americans for Prosperity. From 2017 to 2019, he served as the Deputy Assistant Administrator for Air and Radiation at the EPA and previously worked as Executive Director for the Association of Air Pollution Control Agencies and in positions with the U.S. House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology, American Legislative Exchange Council, and the Recreation Vehicle Industry Association. At this point, I'm going to turn the program over to Rachel Jones.
Thanks so much, Darren. Appreciate the opportunity for us to kind of take a moment to think through what really is in these rules. I know the last month or two has been quite a whirlwind of activity all over, and some of these things we haven't gotten to kind of unpack together. And so I'm looking forward, especially to the Q&A time. I won't spend a ton of time sort of detailing every single requirement in the, I actually like to call it the accounting rule. I think the agency called it that in some of their different, press releases related to this. But I really think it's worth taking a moment to kind of take a 30,000 foot view of things and say, kind of, what's the goal here? What is this actually doing? And really, I'd say this is about fairness. I've kind of shared this analogy before. I kind of view this as similar to discovery in a lawsuit. So if you really want to achieve justice in the actual courtroom, that sort of pre-courtroom discovery phase where everyone, you know, gets a shared set of facts and understands, you know, what the decision can and will be based on, that's really important. And that's what this rule is doing. So I think a lot of people, if they haven't had a chance to read it, assume that it's just about how you weigh costs versus benefits, or, you know, some sort of a metric or litmus test on that. And that's not really the core focus of this rule. The focus of the rule is really kind of, how do you get to a benefit number? How do you get to a cost number? And, you know, for a long time, that process has not been sort of laid out ahead of time. And so we end up with all of these sort of fights over, you know, what the number is, what it should be, how did you get there, what did you use? And I think that the goal of this rule is to say, hey, here's the metric. Here's how we're going to go about getting to a benefit number, getting to a cost number. Here's how we're going to communicate it to the public. And then here's, you know, how we're going to explain to the public how we used, you know, these different metrics to ultimately arrive at a regulatory decision. And so, you know, there are very specific pieces of it related to, you know, requiring that a benefit cost analysis has to be done in all significant things, you know, making sure that there's consistency and clarity in how those, you know, different metrics are communicated to the public. We've seen that change between different administrations, and I think this will really help provide some long-term stability there. And then also a lot of what is here is sort of what I'd call the risk-related requirements. And that really is that sort of accounting type requirements here, where it's unpacking exactly what the agency is going to do to arrive at those different benefit and cost numbers. So there's a lot of details in the rule, and I think a lot of people haven't taken the time to read or look at it. But ultimately, I think it's about fairness. And, you know, from the perspective of manufacturers, we want to do the right thing. I talk to members all the time, whether it's under the Clean Air Act or something else. They want to know, you know, what the rules are and how to follow them. But the frustration is often that it wasn't clearly laid out how the agency would arrive at its decision. And so things can be a little bit of a surprise. And then we end up, you know, having litigation on the back end. And, you know, the Clean Air Act, I don't think, was ever intended to create rules that are then endlessly litigated. If we can work on sort of a shared set of facts on the front end and really get that engagement, then ultimately we'll end up, you know, our goal is less litigation. And if that's what we can achieve, then we'll end up with cleaner air faster. You know, the people, protecting people and the planet is really the goal. And I think we can achieve that, you know, with more engagement on the front end, a better understanding of how the agency will arrive at its decisions. And that ultimately creates stability that really lets, you know, manufacturers in America be able to compete globally. And so I really am optimistic about this rule and think that it could really make a significant and beneficial difference for, you know, people, the planet, and manufacturers. So that's kind of my nutshell overview of things. But like I said before, really looking forward to kind of some back and forth and questions that folks might have and other perspectives people might share. Thanks, Darren.
Thanks. Yeah, thank you, Rachel. Appreciate it. Clint, I'm going to turn it over to you to discuss the science transparency rule.
Great. Well, thanks so much, Darren, for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here and to join the Federal Society and Rachel and talking about two, I think, really important actions by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. And excited to talk about their strengthening transparency and pivotal science underlying significant regulatory actions and influential scientific information rule, which is a mouthful, but thought it might be helpful to talk a little bit, I think, about the backdrop around this rule. And I think there's some key commonality between these two actions by the agency and a move towards greater transparency and the way that the agency calculates costs and benefits and ultimately develops science-based rulemaking. Some differences, but then also to talk through a few of the key provisions and terms within the bill, because I think there's some concepts that may be new to some of the folks listening and that may create some interesting challenges and a little bit about where we may be going from here. So I think the long story short is I think that, you know, this rule culminates after a proposed rule in early 2018 and then a supplemental notice of proposed rulemaking that asked some separate questions in early 2020, but really is inspired, I think, by a pretty simple concept and a pretty nonpartisan concept, which is that our government decisions and in particular regulations that may cost Americans billions of dollars a year, you know, in various costs, ought to be based upon transparent science. And that includes studies that are strong and peer-reviewed and ultimately data that can be independently validated. I think there's an important corollary that's represented in some of the provisions as well, that taxpayer-funded science also ought to be open to the American people. And I think that's really, you know, I think if you removed some of the more controversial elements and didn't mention the Trump administration or EPA, you'd probably find strong majorities of all parties that would support that concept. And obviously, there's been lots of discussion on Capitol Hill over the last decade over some of these issues. And really, I think the agency has been striving towards this ideal for decades. In the early 1980s, Administrator Ruckelshaus issued a fishbowl memo, which described how the agency wanted to operate as though it was in a fishbowl. They realized that they were at the center of a number of controversial rules and important questions about the state of the science and regulatory costs, and that their engagement with stakeholders, their engagement with science needed to be open to the world. And since that time, we've seen really across administrations commitments towards that end. And frankly, I think this rule is an attempt to operationalize and codify some of those commitments in a really important way. I think the other dynamic that may be worth mentioning here is just this happens against the backdrop of what I think are some legitimate questions about our peer review system. You know, peer review is incredibly important. I think in many ways that the strengths of this final rule are emphasizing why independent peer review for important government science-based decisions is critical. But as we've seen with what some people refer to as the replication or replicability crisis across a number of environmental and other sciences, you know, there's a widespread issue where a number of studies are unable to be replicated when given access. And I think you've seen a strong push for data sharing and open access. And in many ways, this rule is designed for those scientists that are interested in having policy-relevant research that's used by government for regulatory decisions to create a norm and incentivize more data sharing for their colleagues to help ensure that their results are sound and ought to be the basis for notice and comment rulemaking. Finally, I'll just note, and Darren, you touched on this, I think this is very much grounded in decades of agency science-based decisions going back to the 1980s and a number of policies that have been adopted. So that includes guidelines adopted in the Obama administration related to scientific integrity, as well as implementation of the Information Quality Act that has resulted in the agency adopting handbooks on risk characterization and peer review. All of these documents include, frankly, very similar statements to what's contained in the final rule about the need for independent validation, the need for replicable or reproducible science, the need to shift away from certain kinds of models or closed data sets when promulgating important regulations. And I think really, you know, this rule is about our regulatory system deserving better. Peer review is important, but it's probably not sufficient. And in many ways, the use over the years of non-transparent science, you know, studies that are funded by taxpayers that are behind paywalls, the use of proprietary and black box models for key regulatory inputs, has been a trend across administrations for decades. And as I think a lot of your listeners probably know, EPA regulations, and in particular EPA air quality regulations, loom large among the costs and the benefits for all federal regulations, as well as in the field of administrative law. Actually, just this morning, the White House Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs released their annual report to Congress on the costs and benefits of all federal regulations over the last few years. And that document, I think, has been around for about 20 years. And just about each year, EPA air quality regulations represent more costs and more benefits than all other federal regulations combined, which is a pretty astonishing thought. So I think there's some questions about why EPA is pursuing this and in this way, but I think it does represent really kind of the tip of the iceberg for reforms to the administrative state that are very, very important. So just want to talk super quickly about some of the things in the rule, and I'll just maybe start with some of the things that are not in the rule, because I think this one has received substantial attention and controversy. Colleague Robert Hahn published an excellent piece after the first proposal back in 2018 in the Washington Post. And just to paraphrase the lead there, he said, Administrator Scott Pruitt at EPA has proposed a very controversial rule that has received a substantial amount of feedback from politicians and scientific societies and NGOs, and it would be great if any of them had read it. And I think a similar conclusion exists in response to this final rule and some of the headlines that have been mischaracterized about what are in the rule. So just a few things. This rule does not require that any studies or science be categorically excluded. It is not a censoring science rule. It is an attempt, in fact, just to give greater weight to studies that are open and independently validated. It doesn't require the release of any personally identifiable information or confidential business information. It would not preclude any particular studies or case studies. People have suggested, I've seen in a few press reports, that the rule would somehow impact things like clinical trials for vaccines or a study of a particular oil spill. That is absolutely not the case. All that it asks is that the agency take a close look and, frankly, be less opaque about how it selects the studies and science that undergirds its decisions, and give greater weight to those studies that an independent scientist could validate, which does not mean recreate the study. So the rule includes, I think, a number of important provisions, and I'll just talk real briefly about some of those. It requires, it establishes how EPA considers the availability of dose response data that underlies pivotal science using significant regulatory actions and influential scientific information. Not to belabor the point too much, but it then defines kind of each of those terms. So it talks about dose response data, which is narrowly defined as the quantitative relationship between the dose or exposure of a pollutant, contaminant, or substance and an effect. Significant regulatory actions is defined as the same as in Executive Order 12866, which includes a wide variety of requirements, but can include the overall cost or benefit of the rule exceeding $100 million, being novel, influential, et cetera, and subject to interagency review. And then it also impacts influential scientific information, which is that science that the agency reasonably determines has a clear and substantial impact on important public policies or private sector decisions. The rule only applies to future regulatory actions and scientific information. And so under the rule, EPA is to give greater consideration to studies where the underlying data are available in a manner sufficient for independent validation. But then it also indicates a number of criteria by which the EPA administrator may think about utilizing studies that maybe don't have access. And that includes studies that have data that are available to anyone, but also tiered or restricted access that may only be limited to certain researchers to ensure that there's protections for privacy and confidentiality and other unique situations with certain data sets. It also provides a number of exemptions. I think in many ways, the future administration could very easily navigate these and continue to carry out their science-based decisions across their environmental statutes. So those exemptions include if there's a conflict between this rule and the EPA environmental statutes they administer, then those environmental statutes win out. It also doesn't apply to any adjudications or permit proceedings or enforcement actions, but only really national rulemakings. And then the administrator can also grant case-by-case exemptions to the requirements of the rule, which I think is really an important element. So in many ways, I think a lot of the mischaracterizations and hypotheticals that have characterized the final rules coverage are mistaken. I also think there's some important relationship between this rule and a number of those existing environmental statutes, whether it's the Clean Air Act or Clean Water Act or Safe Drinking Water Act. A number of our environmental statutes include important provisions about the use of science, transparency, and data. For example, Section 307D of the Clean Air Act that establishes standards of review for National Clean Air Act rulemaking requires that the agency release the factual data, methodology, and major policy considerations that accompany a rule upon proposal. And so I think in many ways, this rule helps to carry that out. Differently than the accounting rule, as Rachel described, it is a rule that exists across different EPA programs and across different environmental statutes that applies, whether it's the EPA Office of Air or Water or the Superfund Office, among others. And it also, rather than identifying particular statutory authority in those environmental statutes, is based upon the general federal housekeeping statutes. And so as a result of that, there's a quick challenge in the Eastern District Court of Montana to the rule that seeks for expedited relief. So happy to talk more about sort of the fate of the rule, what it may mean in the future administration, and how it may be interpreted by EPA administrators in the future. But we'll just maybe conclude this portion by saying I think there's a really important element here, and I'd encourage folks to take a closer look at what's in the final rule and how it may ultimately get to that goal of open government decision-making and sound scientific review so that the American people can ensure that our regulations serve them best.
Thank you, Clint. That's great. So we're going to let me ask some initial questions. We'll have a little bit of a fireside chat, and then we'll open it up for audience Q&A in a second. I guess the first question I'd like to ask you, Rachel, there have been reports that the benefit-cost rule will limit what kind of benefits can be considered in Clean Air Act rulemaking. In particular, there seems to be a concern regarding the use of co-benefits. First of all, can you explain what co-benefits even refer to? And is this alleged limitation true? And finally, if my understanding is correct about the rule, why the EPA, why would the EPA want to separate out direct benefits from co-benefits?
Sure. So this is an area where there's been a lot of, I think, misinformation floating around. I wish folks would take the time to read a rule before they start to opine on it. So this rule does not prohibit the use of co-benefits. And in fact, you know, in some ways, I think does a lot of service to this area. So there have been a lot of folks who've been very frustrated over co-benefits being folded in and used in rules, and that's been an area of controversy. And so what EPA has done here in this rule to I hope, really kind of alleviate this controversy is to require separate reporting of your statutory objective benefits. So, for example, if you have a NAAQS rule that is supposed to target ozone, then you would have that's the statutory objective, right? If this is a ozone NAAQS standard that you're setting. And then co-benefits would be that sometimes what you see is when you regulate for a certain pollutant, you actually end up seeing reductions in other pollutants. And so, you know, that's a good thing. We certainly wouldn't want to discourage, you know, additional cleanup of the air. But those are co-benefits, meaning those are sort of bonuses, if you will, to what the actual statutory objective is. And so what has led to confusion in the past is sometimes those have been folded in, and sometimes those co-benefits, you know, may be able to be targeted more effectively under the actual statutory provisions that were, you know, created for those. And so again, sometimes that's true, sometimes it's not. But what they've done here is simply require that EPA reports those separately. And so that, you know, when the public is looking, they can really understand better, you know, this particular statutory objective, here are the benefits or costs here. And then also here are additional benefits or costs. I think it'll really give everyone, again, sort of a more level playing field as far as really understanding what are the different pieces. As somewhat analogous type thing is if you think about like a nutrition label, right, where it tells you the different types of, element, okay, this much of the total calories is from fat. This is from carbohydrates. This is from protein. And so again, it's not in any way, trying to prevent, taking those into account, but it gives everyone the ability to sort of see the different elements, that would make up what the projected, again, all of this is modeled, but the projected, benefits and costs of a rule would be.
Great, Rachel, to follow up, to clarify, so the final rule doesn't in any way require that the agency doesn't dictate like how much weight to give co-benefits versus direct benefits or how to even necessarily conduct a benefit cost analysis. I mean, it basically just listing information. Is that correct?
Well, no, I would say yes and no. So it does actually give a lot of parameters about how they go about getting to their cost and benefit number. So how you do that analysis. That certainly, I think those details are laid out in a very helpful way that hasn't always been, laid out before. But you're correct. It doesn't require the agency to weigh them in a certain way, but rather it does require the agency to explain how they did choose to consider these different things. And so that's another, I think, really important and helpful element is that the agency has to articulate that. And I think that will be helpful in the future so that, you look at what the Supreme Court said in Michigan and, I think we'll end up with better rules now that there's a requirement that EPA spells out exactly how they used and how they weighed both the statutory objective and then co-benefits that may be present.
Thanks. Clint, regarding the science transparency rule, you mentioned something called tiered access to underlying dose response data. Can you just explain a little bit more what that's referring to?
Yeah, so I think one of the important caveats within the final rule is to establish that EPA greater consideration for dose response data that is available for independent validation includes open access. So, frankly, there's a really important and valuable movement towards this end. A lot of journals have rightfully shifted towards a requirement for publication that you make available the underlying data or data sufficient for an independent researcher to understand, extend, and test your conclusions is a requirement for most major peer-reviewed journals at this point. There are, I think, certain kinds of data, and EPA has a lot of discussion, received a lot of comments on different environmental science disciplines and where there may be some important considerations and where you may want to have sort of managed access that is limited to folks who come from that academic background and can understand and meaningfully use the data. I will say as a general matter, and this has been true for decades and has gotten even more true in recent years, and this is something that I think has been confirmed by the National Academies and really across scientific disciplines, there are very easy tools that can be used to de-identify and mask data that allows for analysis without any personal or privacy or any other issues that may exist around national security or whatever else. The vast majority of EPA decisions are based upon science in which there are a number of studies and competing studies. And so really, in many ways, I think the rule is about how openly the agency describes their science policy decisions. So how do you weigh this study versus that study? What is the weight of the evidence? Rachel mentioned national ambient air quality standards and a regular occurrence for review of those standards for traditional pollutants like ozone or particulate matter or lead. They generally cite thousands of studies and go through a process where you start with the state of the science and ultimately lead to, proposed and final rules to retain or revise a national standard that, could result in billions of dollars of cost and billions of dollars of health benefit and are really, really important. And in that case, in fact, the Supreme Court and EPA, has determined that consideration of cost and implementation aren't a factor. So science is really, really important. But then how do you decide when there's 100 studies that speak to the effects of ground level ozone on asthma for a particular population? And I think this is really for the first time in a rule, the agency has laid out how they think the administrator ought to approach it. And not an ironclad rule that says, you know, thou shall only use this kind of study, but instead a series of considerations. And I think it's really important that it's in a rulemaking process, because I often think of the guidelines that exist in EPA's, you know, peer review handbooks and guidance documents and other scientific policy, you know, framing devices that the agency has used in the past. In many ways, are only as good as the paper they're written on and the people who are reading them, right? And in many ways, those documents that don't have a binding effect that restricts the agency in any way serves as the connective tissue of the administrative state across administrations. I think for the first time, the agency is saying, this is how we think this should be interpreted. This is why we think greater weight should be given to these kinds of studies. And there's also some important exemptions. So I think, you know, in many ways, the final rule really sets that up in a way that's very helpful, but probably also in a way in which a future EPA administrator that wanted to come to a certain outcome could. I think there's a legitimate concern, I think, about the ways that the thumb on the scale of those science policy decisions has taken place in the past. This goes back to the 1980s. We had a very active debate about risk management and how we could separate risk management and regulation from risk assessment. And I think folks legitimately have said, hey, you know, I'm concerned that the way you pick studies ultimately lead to the conclusion that you want, whether that results in a more or less burdensome regulatory approach. So I think in many ways, this opens up that process, describes how EPA intends to achieve it, and then really sets a fairly high bar for the agency to describe why they did that in the future. I will just say to I think Rachel's point, in my reading of both of these rules is not that it would have necessarily undermined, or I think you could have come to a similar substantive conclusion for virtually any major EPA regulation in the last several administrations under both of these rules. The main difference from the combination of these two rules is, you know, a whole lot more about how they got to the calculation of costs and benefits and the consideration of science than you would have previously. So I think that's really the great contribution that these two make to the administrative legal process.
Thanks, Clint. So Micah, I think we're ready to start fielding questions. So if you can kind of give the directions and get the questions in queue, and I'll, as you're doing that, I'll ask another question.
Absolutely. Let's go ahead and open up that floor for audience questions. And while we're waiting for those questions to come in, Darren, I'll toss it back over to you.
Thanks. Let me ask a question to both of you, Rachel and Clint. There are some who hope that the rules would actually do a lot more to promote a sound benefit cost analysis and sound science. These rules seem to be a small step forward. What would you say to those who think the rules don't go far enough? Rachel, I'll start with you.
I think that we need to live in the world of the possible, and you know, don't. It might sound trite, but don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. You know, folks who say this is a small step and it needs to be a lot more, I would argue that if you, for example, especially on the benefit cost rule, some people had asked, you know, for, you know, a requirement that, you know, benefits must exceed the cost. If you want that, then you need to get Congress to change the Clean Air Act. And so I think EPA did a really good job of being respectful of exactly what the act says and the intent there, and then creating a rule that will, you know, strengthen their ability to fulfill and execute on what, you know, Congress told EPA to do under the Clean Air Act. But the other observation I would just make is it's interesting that there's this dichotomy where we have some folks saying this needs to go a whole lot further, it's too much of a baby step, and at the same time you have people saying, you know, the sky is falling. So I think usually when you end up with kind of those sort of differing views on the exact same thing, sometimes that's an indication of, you know, you landed somewhere in the middle, you know, a fair balance. And so that's kind of the observations that I would make, you know, about sort of that question of, is this enough? Is this too much? I'd say it's kind of in the Goldilocks zone. It's just right.
What do you think?
Yeah, so it's a really good question. And I agree with Rachel in that I think, and this is often the case, especially when we're talking about, you know, binding regulation, which is a really unique thing, right? You know, in many ways, the Trump administration has been unique in a wide variety of ways when it approaches regulatory reform. But, you know, the idea of establishing not one, but two rules that restrict the agency's, you know, operation in terms of how it develops regulation is really a pretty unique dynamic. But the fact that we're talking about binding regulation to apply to a regulator for rules that are now being developed decades after the Clean Air Act and Clean Water Act were last significantly revisited by Congress is a pretty astonishing one. I think from the perspective of Americans for Prosperity, we think there needs to be dramatically more legislative accountability, revisiting of our outdated statutes to meaningfully rescind and red tape and restrict the administrative state in a way much more consistent with how we view the three branches ought to operate. I will say, I think folks who raise those concerns about these rules not going far enough, I agree with them. I think in many ways, this is not a silver bullet. I think there's a number of ways, even absent reversal of this rule, either through the use of the Congressional Review Act or the potential for notice and comment rulemaking to rescind this action, or a change in litigation posture and a potential stay from a district court. I think there's a number of ways in which a future administration, even one that has much more ambitious regulatory goals than the Trump administration has, to work within this and frankly to pursue those same goals in a way that is more transparent. And I think that there's some pretty big loopholes, right? And so whether it's providing case-by-case exemptions, the definition in the science rule of dose response data and significant regulatory actions, that really limits you to, you know, frankly, just a few data sets for just a few rules each year, and they tend to be the big ticket ones. And then there's a wide variety of ways in which I think an administrator could articulate why they decided to not give greater consideration to a study that is more open, more public, and available for independent validation. I think in most cases that would probably not be persuasive to me, but I think it may help change the dynamics in terms of the federal judiciary's deference on some of these key technical issues. And by articulating those in a rule, I think the agency has a higher burden to overcome in the future in explaining why it deviates from that approach. And so I think in many ways it is the best that we could hope for based upon where we are in terms of disconnection of the administrative state from actual elected officials. And in many ways, that's a call for us to get away from statutory obsolescence and to think about how our environmental statutes need to be reinvigorated with 21st century ideas.
Thanks. Micah, do we have any questions in the queue at this point?
Yes, we have one caller in the queue. We'll move to that person.
Hi, my question is for Rachel. One criticism of the rule that I've heard is that while it doesn't explicitly dictate the value of benefits versus co-benefits, the fact is that co-benefits are devalued from previous calculations that were done before this rule, because when a policy or regulation is reviewed, supposedly under case law or guidance, it's dictated that only the statutory benefits are truly considered. And so therefore, the benefit side of the cost-benefit ratio goes down following this rule. Admittedly, I haven't read the rule, so I don't know whether this criticism is a symptom of folks just not reading the rule or not fully understanding the context or framework, but I'm curious if you have any thoughts on that criticism.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting one. I do think it is largely that folks have not read the rule. And I know we're all busy and it's really hard. And, you know, we read snippets and, you know, that we all sometimes don't have the full set of facts before we have our opinions. And I think that leads to a lot of confusion and you know, angst that maybe didn't need to be there. I don't agree sort of with the idea that this rule is written or somehow reduces the benefit side of the ratio, if you will. You know, I agree with Clint's point earlier that I don't think that this would have necessarily changed, you know, rules over, you know, many administrations in the past as far as maybe what the outcome was, but this really gives people a much better opportunity to see all the details of sort of why and how you get to where you land. So, I mean, the only I would say sort of change that maybe I could see, you know, this doing is they take a few steps to make sure that there's not double counting of benefits or costs, right? So it's on both sides. And so that, you know, could be there have been a few instances in the past where folks feel like, you know, when you have multiple rules that are sort of in a proposal stage at the same time, or you see, you know, making sure your baselines line up. So there could be, you know, some differences when you follow, you know, the full protocol, if you will. But the other, I think, really important thing for folks to think about is that, you know, any of these changes, they apply to sort of both sides of, you know, the benefit and cost paradigm. So if there's changes that would, you know, change the benefits, then, you know, the same thing would happen kind of on the cost side. And then the other thing just to remember is that this is nothing to obviously change the Clean Air Act itself, and requirements in the Clean Air Act are kind of different from section to section as to when you take a look at, you know, benefits and costs. Sometimes it's really early, sometimes it's really late, and sometimes it's after you've kind of arrived at the requirements that you're going to arrive at. You know, it's very science only driven. And so I think it's a really interesting approach they've taken, and I think is one that does a good job of, you know, fitting well with very different regulatory approaches that you find in different sections of the Clean Air Act.
I don't know if any other questions. Oh, sorry, yeah, Richard.
No other questions lined up in the queue as of now. So, Darren, I'll toss it back over to you.
Okay, thanks. So, Clint had mentioned the Congressional Review Act, so I just wanted to ask a question about that to both of you. So there's a lot of interest in whether these rules could be subject to the Congressional Review Act. Could you, either one of you, briefly explain what the Congressional Review Act does? And what, do you think these rules could be subject to the Congressional Review Act? How about Clem? Why don't you take a shot at it?
Absolutely. So the Congressional Review Act of 1996 provides for an expedited process for both chambers of Congress to adopt a joint resolution of disapproval for a regulation, and only requires a simple majority and then the signature of the president. So this has been used pretty sparingly in the past, at least prior to 2017. It was only used to reverse the ergonomics rule at the end of the Clinton administration. And then in 2017, got a lot more use early in the Trump administration for a wide variety of reasons, including Republican majorities in both chambers and a president willing to use it. So in many ways, it is it requires, and I think the Senate is probably, as usual, the long pole in the tent in terms of process, but requires 10 hours of Senate debate on a particular resolution of disapproval for a rule. I've seen some misconceptions even just in the last few days about what rules it applies to. So it has some special procedures for major rules, which include, it kind of has the same definition as significant rules under Executive Order 12866. So rules that have costs or benefits above $100 million, among other things. It actually applies to any rule broadly defined, and both the Government Accountability Office and the Office of Management and Budget has broadly read that to include guidance documents. The definition of rule in the CRA matches up with the Administrative Procedures Act definition, but then provides for additional exceptions. And I think for these two rules, I think the EPA interpretation, partly to justify having an immediate effective date, but then also have argued that neither are subject to the Congressional Review Act because they satisfy one of those three exceptions to the definition of rule by virtue of being internal to the agency, procedural, et cetera. So I think EPA's opening bid is they don't need to submit these actions to Congress to potentially be reversed through the use of the Congressional Review Act because of the nature of the rulemaking. I think there are some open questions about whether or not Congress agrees with that view or may want to take these up. I think perhaps of the two, the science transparency rule strikes me as probably within a half dozen or maybe 10 actions that I would expect the new Senate majority to probably prioritize early in a Biden administration as actions that they may want to reverse. And just one more note about the Congressional Review Act. Maybe two more notes. Among other things, why Congress may want to do this rather than having a future administration go through notice and comment rulemaking. For one, it prohibits rules that are substantially the same from being promulgated in the future by that same agency. And two, it is precluded from judicial review. And so there may be some reasons or some reasons why you wouldn't want to use the Congressional Review Act on a particular action. And so I think we'll see some of those decisions being made probably in real time as the House and Senate consider lots of things, including a number of nominations in a new administration, target-rich environment in terms of some pretty substantial rules since August of 2020, which is kind of the timeline that look-back period covers, as well as impeachment proceedings and other things that are going to take up time on the Senate floor. So there's my much too long-winded answer about how I view it, but I'm very interested to hear from Rachel as well.
Rachel, do you have anything to add to that?
No, I fully agree with Clint. I mean, I think the bottom line is, you know, sometimes we all live in our own little worlds and we think that everyone is focused on the same things we're focused on. And, you know, I think it's worth remembering at the beginning of the Trump administration where you had Republicans who generally tend to love the CRA and want to use it a lot more than historically Democrats have wanted to use it. And so even in that time period, I think we only had, and you'll have to check my number on this, but I think maybe only 14 CRAs actually started moving on the floor from a Senate perspective. And I think maybe even that 14th one didn't ultimately get the final vote on it. But so if you think about across all the different agencies, if you're looking at, you know, financial regulations, immigration related actions, there's a lot of different things that, you know, the outgoing administration did that I think could potentially be, you know, areas of focus. And so I think it's important to remember that there is a limited clock, kind of as Clint laid out really well with all the other competing things. And so I think, you know, possibly, but I also agree with Clint. I think that probably the transparency rule is certainly gotten maybe more attention from a controversy standpoint. And, you know, if everyone's kind of choosing across the whole government, if there was one in the space, you know, that could be. But we'll just, you know, have to say there's like Clint said, a lot of competing things, and the Senate's calendar is such that you know, it's always a knife fight to try to get whatever your issue of the day is to be considered.
Thanks. Micah, do we have any new questions in the queue?
No questions in the queue. I think that's all the questions for today.
Okay, we still have a couple more, that's okay. That we want to kind of get through. But I do encourage people to ask questions. So Rachel, I want to get to this question because I think it's pretty important. Critics of the benefit cost rule argue that they say that the rule is unnecessary because agencies already have to do benefit cost analysis under executive orders. How would you respond to that criticism?
You know, I would kind of two ways. Just because they, you know, you have executive orders or the like that have you do what I would consider more of a back end analysis. You know, an RIA is that kind of a after the fact taking a look at things. Those are important requirements, and this rule locks in the requirement in a rulemaking, which obviously is more durable. But what I would say is that the goal of this rule is really less about sort of a back end analysis and much more about, you know, as I kind of mentioned earlier at the beginning, this is the discovery phase in a lawsuit, if you will. And so this is really laying out the process that EPA will go through in benefit cost analysis. It's less about sort of just that you do it, because just because you do it doesn't really matter if you can't ensure the quality of, you know, a benefit number you land at and a cost number you land at. And so just saying we're going to weigh the benefits and costs in some ways is kind of meaningless if you don't know how you get to those numbers, and not just know how, but have a predictable, you know, decided ahead of time type of a structure. That framework for arriving at benefit numbers and cost numbers is incredibly important so that you can have assurance that the quality of what those numbers look like is really something that you can rely on.
Thanks. You know, one of the key issues for both these rules is the ability for the public and others to enforce the requirements of these rules. Just can Clint and Rachel, can you just kind of discuss the enforceability issues connected to these rules and whether or not they will be enforceable in the court?
Yeah, Darren, I think that's a really good question. I think we've seen, you know, an interesting history here, you know, with actions like the Information Quality Act that established some criteria for agencies to adopt in terms of peer review and information quality for any disseminated information that has not had the impact that I think those of us who'd like to see more open science would like to have seen. Anyways, I think Rachel's in a better position to talk about some of the key provisions of the cost, benefit, and accounting rule. The science transparency rule is fairly silent here. It, you know, identifies a separate authority under the federal housekeeping statute. I think you would see, you know, arguments in applying this rule related to particular rulemakings that may also cite, as I mentioned before, some of the provisions of our environmental statutes that also encourage transparent science decision making. And so in many ways, I think there's some open questions. I think there may be some lessons to be learned, but I think it does provide a potential tool in the toolbox and maybe a little bit more clarity when it comes to the accounting rule than the science transparency rule about enforceability. But I'll defer to Rachel on that front.
Yeah, I agree with Clint, and especially in the importance kind of this question. I mean, I actually think we're going to have to wait and see, right? I think ultimately whether you can sort of enforce this against the agency, I think that question will probably, you know, ultimately be litigated at some time, you know, sometime in the future if the agency doesn't follow, you know, its own rules. What is pretty clear, and I would encourage folks to kind of read that section of the rule itself. There's a really good legal discussion in the preamble of this exact question. I think probably the EPA really, you know, kind of thought a lot about it. You can tell in reading it, and there certainly were a lot of comments that were filed discussing this exact question. And so you can see the thought, you know, really clarifying and crystallizing between the proposal and then the final rule. But I, you know, the agency certainly takes a position that, you know, this does bind the agency and it is enforceable against the agency in the future if they failed to follow the framework here. I think that there's a lot of pretty good case law on that. I think the question will be, though, or the other relevant question on this will be, well, what's the remedy? So does it, you know, remand it to the agency, and what happens during that remand? That I think is not you know, addressed as far as I recall in the rule itself, and I think will be an important question in future. But I mean, my hope is that we don't ever have to, you know, worry about that. My real hope is that the agency will follow its own rules, that the agency, and Clint raised this, I think, earlier, you know, both of these rules, I think, really track with promises and commitments that the agency has made for decades. And so, again, you know, my hope would be that they would follow both of these rules in a way that, you know, ultimately gets us better, you know, air rules faster to protect people and the planet, kind of as I said before. So is an interesting question. My hope is that we won't even have to worry about that.
Rachel and Clint, thank you so much for this great discussion. And I want to thank everybody for calling in today. And over to you, Micah.
Absolutely. Thank you, Darren. And on behalf of the Federalist Society, I'd like to thank all of our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. You're welcome to listener feedback by email at info@fedshock.org. Thanks to all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleform, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.